Well, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. I will start with a confession, or perhaps it's an apology. Somebody told me once, somebody from Calcutta actually told me that in the West you start every talk with a joke, and in the East you start every talk with an apology. So I will apologize. I actually am a physicist. We were told this morning that Lars Bildsten was the last physicist to speak this morning, and that was in fact not true. I actually think that gives me a little bit of a different perspective on this subject, which I'll touch upon at the beginning and then again at the end of my talk. Okay, so I'm talking about granular flows and avalanches. Avalanche, I'll start just by saying that the word avalanche has acquired a somewhat different meaning in physics than it has in the earth sciences. And I think that the origins of that is an interesting exercise in the history of science. The avalanche studies in physics grew out of what I would call a statistical mechanics approach. Thank you. Developed first in the 80s, and it was a very active field for about 15 years. Thank you. The real appeal of that approach was that it was in fact not based on continuum or phenomenological theories. It was based on very physical, very mechanical theories of grain scale processes. And the overall kind of aesthetic of the field was to focus on the statistical properties of avalanches down a slope, and also on pattern formation. And it was a body of theory that was most developed for very highly intermittent flows. Okay. So that was the strength. The weakness was that it actually gave a very poor account of avalanches as they actually take place in granular flows. Which emerged from granular flow experiments in the laboratory, which I think was one of the real positive things that came out of this series of studies, was that a lot of granular effects in the laboratory were studied carefully, which had never been studied as carefully before, and that led to things like the Poulikan rheology that we heard about in the previous talk and so forth. And what you see now, in fact, is that if you, in the physics literature, if you look for papers that have the word avalanche in the title or abstract, published in the last 5 or 10 years, you will find that, in fact, they're not about avalanches. The avalanche has become a metaphor. People talk about avalanches in Birkhausen noise and solid state physics and a lot of phenomena like that. Absolutely. So what I'm going to talk about in this talk is more of a fluid mechanics approach, which are based on simple equations, conservation laws, and approximations more or less sophisticated to the rheology of flows. And I think this is a subject which, in my mind, and this is a personal point of view, that really gets going in 1999 with the emergence of the Poulikan flow rule for dense granular flows, and I'll say a word about that later. and it's interesting that it has, as a subject, it has kind of a complementary strength and weakness to the statistical mechanical work, which is the overall connection to particle mechanics is weak. And I think that that's the biggest weakness, actually, of this area of study at the moment. And again, this is something we heard touched upon this morning, which is, when you look at phenomena like erosion, we're really only starting to understand how to connect real mechanical properties of the grains to continuum properties of the flows. And then the final comment about the fluid mechanics approach is that it's most developed for relatively steady or close to steady state flows. What I'm going to talk about is an imprudent attempt to use some of the same approaches to understand actually highly intermittent avalanche flows. Okay. So the regime that I'm talking about is a regime that you can call dense granular flow. So there is, if you look at very slow flows, kind of quasi-static flows, cases where there really is no time scale in the system, and most of the phenomena tend to be independent of shear rate. That's really just the domain of soil mechanics. Then you have a regime of dense granular flow at somewhat higher shear rates, where you really have a multi-particle contact network that is controlling the rheological behavior of the system. And then as you go even further and extend the shear rate to higher rates, you start to get collisional flows. And these have constitutive relations that really can be derived from kinetic theory. And here, actually, you start to move into a domain where I think the microscopic theory is relatively well-founded, partly due to the work of people who are in this room. Now, these are all dry flows. And of course, if we want to do physical geology with these kinds of problems, we're going to have to take account of the fact that there are typically fluids around. And that leads either to what you might call wet, dense granular flows, such as debris flows, or turbidity currents as you reduce the density. So I came here this week because I'm eager to learn about the current state of the art in these two subjects, which are of geophysical importance. But I have almost nothing to say about those myself in this talk. So I will remain dry. So, thank you. At least for now. So for the dry dense granular flows, this is an area where I think the last 10 years really is a success story of a convergence of experimental, some theoretical, and some computational techniques that have really laid out a consistent and quite powerful picture of the rheological behavior of these flows. So this is an old graph from an old article, one of the first articles of Poulikan. Actually, I think this is from Silbert et al. So there are certainly modifications to this, but this gives the basic idea, which is, if you are on an inclined plane, which is, in a lot of ways, in my opinion, the easiest flow geometry to really understand, and you look at the height of the flow versus the angle of inclination of the plane, there's a domain of no flow, and then there is a critical angle as a function of height above which it's possible to have stable flow. And this angle is not the angle of repose, which is a slightly higher angle or a slightly deeper flow bed. So there is a hysteretic region which is not shown here. But basically, you have a region of stable flow separated by a region of no flow with a critical height, h sub s of theta. Yes?
Does h make dimensionality with the particle diameter, grain diameter?
Yes.
Okay.
So what Poulikan said was that if you look at u over square root of gh, which is a basic Frewden number for the flow, that this is linear in h over hs of theta. And for some materials, this has been corrected by adding a constant term here on the right-hand side. And there are more sophisticated forms of the right-hand side as well, qualitatively similar. There's one due to our organizer, Jim Jenkins. Which typically, give equivalent or even better fit to the experimental data than the original Poulikan form. This is a remarkable form from the point of view of microscopic physics, because what it says is that if I'm up here deep in the stable flow regime, and I look at the rheology, the overall velocity of the flow, it knows what is the height at which the sand pile will stop flowing. And that's actually a remarkable fact, and one that is surprisingly difficult to recover in microscopic theoretical treatments. Okay. So this is established for steady state and near steady state conditions, and it's usually established for spherical grains. So now what I'd like to do is take this and see if we can use this to understand a highly intermittent avalanche regime. So this is really inspired by the experiments of Borsoni and Bob Ecky at Los Alamos. And so they set up an incline. The overall length scale here is like perhaps 4 meters downslope and a meter or so across. And they basically feed the slope with particles from the top. They have a variety of optical techniques to determine both the altitude of the flow at any point downslope and individual particle velocities. So, you know, I'm not the best person to talk about the experiments, but you know, it uses all of the optical techniques that have really been developed for understanding the detailed mechanics of these kinds of granular flows. And they, unlike a lot of these experiments, they were really interested in the effect of non-sphericity of the particles. So although they did use glass beads, the classic kind of laboratory granular material, they also used sand, two different sizes of sand, salt, and a set of copper particles varying from highly dendritic copper particles, the roughest possible ones you could get, to things that were close to being spherical. So the idea here was to try to explore a full range of non-sphericity in the behavior of the materials. And so if you look at the overall flow character for these different particles, well, you get a qualitatively simple phase diagram, if you like, that's similar to what I showed you at the outset, of height, non-dimensionalized to the particle diameter, versus angle. And it was, there's no theory behind this, it's just a convenient fitting form. But this can be conveniently fit as a constant over tangent theta minus tangent theta 1, where A1 and theta 1 have to be adjusted somewhat for each particle type that you're working with. And the Poulikan flow rule, or it's the Jenkins form, which is somewhat modified, was well satisfied for the sand and the glass beads. Rather interestingly, it was not well satisfied for the copper particles. So the distinctive feature of the Poulikan flow rule, so I am innovating by using chalk to communicate a scientific idea, but then I have to find some chalk. So you will recall that the Poulikan flow rule was U over square root of GH was equal to beta H over H sub S, or U goes as H to the 3/2, which is a very old result derived on dimensional grounds by Bagnall over 50 years ago. And what's interesting, the copper particles don't obey this. The copper particles have a behavior that's much closer to U proportional to H. So something is happening in the rheology and the flow profile, the flow for those particles, that is quite different. And one of the things that is surprising is that, nevertheless, the treatment of the avalanches turns out to be quite similar for those particles. Okay. The final comment is beta for sand is a factor of 5 or so larger than for glass beads. So if you look at these U being proportional to beta, the sand avalanches are much harder, stronger, and faster compared to the glass bead avalanches.
What's the nature of the diffraction?
So the you just glue one layer of particles at the base.
Same particles.
Well, the I do not think they did that. I think they used basically sand for everything. So it's a little different. But you know, I don't think it's practical to go and make a new bed for each of 8 different kinds of particles.
It might be an effect of the bomb.
That's possible, yes. Okay, so the avalanche. So this is the background. The way the experiment was conducted was that particles were added relatively slowly at the top of the incline, so that you basically saw a series of avalanches down the slope. Particles were not added so quickly that a steady flow developed, but instead you saw avalanches. So if you like, the average angle of the slope was in between the critical angle and the angle of repose. You were operating precisely in that region of metastability of the slope. This is showing a, this is actually, yes, these are sand avalanches. You see there actually is a dependence on the angle. Of course, you see more avalanches. They tend to be a little bit smaller at higher angles. And the overall structure, the avalanches are moving from left to right. The overall structure is kind of, they're a little bit arced, the sand avalanches. The typical structure and velocity, are don't vary dramatically with angle, but there is some variation, which I'm not really going to talk about in this discussion. Okay. So I told you that the sand was fast compared to the glass beads. Okay. And in fact, a lot of things are different about the avalanches. So this shows a picture of the sand avalanche. The horizontal scale is very much compressed here compared to the vertical scale. And you see a kind of peak structure with these kind of wings that come out to the side. Whereas if you look at the glass bead avalanches, it's much more of just a lump moving down the slope. And whereas this clearly has some kind of very strong profile right in the front, this is more of a just simple lump in the front without a dramatic structure at the bow wave of the avalanche. Furthermore, you can also, I told you that the particle velocities, individual particle velocities, could be tracked in this experiment. And looking at the particles, you see actually a very different kinetics of the particles in these two avalanches. So this is a picture of particle tracks. So this is distance versus time. For the glass bead avalanches and for the sand avalanches. And I'm actually going to talk about it in the reverse order. So suppose, let's look at this white line right here. So it's sitting here, it's at rest, there's no change of x with time. And then you see it gradually accelerating and then moving down this curve. And in fact, you see that the velocity of the sand particle is always less than the velocity of the front that is moving. This is the same picture for the glass beads. So for the glass beads, the velocity of the particle is less than the velocity of the front. For the sand, on the other hand, the sand particles accelerate quite suddenly, and they accelerate to a velocity that is greater than the velocity of the front. So, again, to use my auxiliary audiovisual system, if you look at the the glass bead avalanches, you have a lump that is just moving down the slope, and the particles, as I say, are mostly moving up and down, like in a kinematic wave. Whereas for the sand avalanches, you actually see that they are breaking with the particles at the front end of the avalanche actually moving faster than the front, and so it's spilling over.
Which is the x dimension in your sketch?
This is x. X is downslope. I'm not talking about any of the fully three-dimensional structure or lateral structure of the avalanches. I'm just looking at their profiles up and down slope. Okay. So the theory, so I'm going to try to understand this from a theoretical point of view. And so the theory I'm going to use is the depth average theory, which is over a century old for shallow water flows, but was introduced by Savage and Hutter for granular flows. And I'm going to supplement it with the Poulikin flow rule. So the depth average theory, you have an equation for conservation of mass. U here is the average velocity, averaged through the depth of the flow. And then you have a conservation of momentum equation. And this equation has a number of interesting parameters in it. First of all, there's a parameter that depends on the precise nature of the velocity profile through the depth of the flow. So is it a linear velocity profile? Is it a plug flow? Is it a convex Bagnold-type velocity profile? And that for the Bagnold profile, which would be consistent with the classic form of the Poulikin flow rule, that is 5/4. For a linear profile, it's about 4/3. And in fact, fortunately, I mean, 4/3 isn't that different than 5/3. So from a quantitative point of view, maybe it doesn't depend that much for the purposes of this analysis what the precise velocity profile is. Then you look at the right-hand side of this equation, which are the forces accelerating the sand. So there's tangent theta, which is basically the downslope force of gravity. There is the base friction, mu, which is a function of the average velocity and the height of the flow. And then there's this term, which is a normal stress difference times the gradient of the height with distance. And that just reflects the energy you have to exert to basically raise or lower the altitude of the flow in the tilted frame. Now, the normal stress difference is approximately 1. That's a result from numerical studies. The base friction, you can actually determine from the Poulikin flow. Well, yes?
Is there a theoretical justification for that? For using a Basel friction, which comes from a steady experiment into a non-steady equation?
No.
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 Good.
Okay. This the or rather I should say there is an a posteriori justification.
There's it.
An a posteriori justification. The so if you looked at the if you turned off all of the derivatives here, what you would have is tangent theta is equal to the base friction. So since from the Poulikin flow rule you know the relationship between h, theta, and u, you can use the Poulikin flow rule if you're willing to use this assumption that you can use the steady state friction to determine what mu is in this equation. And that's really where the flow rule comes into this calculation. Okay. Okay, so this is it's two first order equations, which is a second order equation. And the overall form of it is hyperbolic. So this is an equation that supports the transmission of waves. And there are velocities associated with those waves, which are basically determined by the overall flow velocity, the Froude number, and these various parameters, alpha and k, that appear in the equation. However, you can also perform an approximation of this equation for a small Froude number. Okay? And that basically approximation consists of setting this quantity equal to 0, ignoring, suppressing the momentum equation, and using this, substituting into the conservation of mass equation to get an effective one first order equation. And that first order equation looks like dh dt plus a dh dx is equal to a rather complicated, a nonlinear function of h and dh dx, where there's a given expression for a. Okay, so, I mean, that's nice. So if you always start with the simplest solution, and this would model a bump moving down the incline. It's kind of a Berger's equation type structure. And you see it looks like a wave structure that moves down with a velocity of approximately a. And there's also going to be a broadening of the wave, a diffusive component to the wave structure as well, as in Berger's equation, with a diffusion term on the right-hand side. And that's fine, except you'll notice I have an expression for C up here and an expression for A up here. And I'm just looking at them. It's not obvious that A should be less than C plus. So we're doing something a little strange because we're saying, well, we have this wave structure, lump, moving down the slope, but it's moving, what if it's moving faster than C plus? Then it's moving faster than the characteristic velocity for the original second order equation, which is a theoretical limit on how fast information can be transported. So that's sick. That is, in fact, wrong. And in fact, this is a situation called wave hierarchy. So there are two possible situations. You can have A between the two characteristic velocities. And then you have these characteristics that are moving relatively quickly. And then you have this slower structure inside. And it is an approximate, although it is true that information travels at the rate of the full characteristics. Most of the information, if you like, in fact, is going at the slower velocity. However, if you find that A exceeds C plus, then these kinetic wave solutions, the kinetic wave velocity rotates over until it's on top of the characteristic velocity, and at that point the solution breaks down. And in fact, that's associated with the appearance of a shock in the solution to the full equations. When you are in this case, you actually don't see shocks in the equation, and in this case, you do. So, what is starting to emerge here is a picture that there are two kinds of avalanches. There's a weak avalanche, which looks like a propagating Berger's pulse. It's a so-called kinematic wave. Now, unfortunately, with Berger's equation would broaden with time with most of the nonlinear terms, and we don't see that. So either it's happening too slowly or more likely there are other effects that I haven't spoken about that confine the size of the pulse. If you compute the front velocity, we get, I would say, an acceptable but not impeccable agreement for the overall front velocity. And in some ways, the more interesting solution is the shock solution, the strong avalanche. In the stationary frame of the shock front, you have material moving in with the front velocity from the right. You have material moving in from the left. If you assume that the particle velocity at the top is the maximal velocity, then you can actually use a shock condition to derive basically a relationship between the ratio of the velocities and the height of the shock wave versus the stationary material it's moving into. And among other things, this implies that UP must be greater than the front velocity at the shock. Okay, so this is the key result, actually, because what we're showing here is for two values of alpha, the value of the height over h sub s critical, and you also see up over uf. And what you see is that if you are in what we would call the subcritical regime, where we think we do have the kinematic solution, the Berger's type solution, up over uf is equal to or less than 1. Whereas on this side, where we would theoretically predict that solution cannot exist, is exactly where we see values of up over uf that are greater than 1. And this is the glass beads down here, this is the sand up here, and we have successfully used the copper particles to interpolate between those two limits.
Excuse me, what are the stars and what are the circles?
Okay, so the stars are up over uf.
Okay.
And the circles are hm over hs.
Yes. And the curves are the
And the curves are the critical values of H. Okay. This is, I'll just take 1 minute because this is actually, this was anticipated actually by Fortier and Poulikin, who looked not at avalanches, but at waves on the surface of a well-established avalanche. Because they looked at sand and glass beads in that circumstance, and they saw, in fact, an instability towards the development of waves for sand, but not for glass beads. And it turns out that the criterion for that is exactly the same as the criterion that we have for the critical versus the kinematical avalanches. The mathematics of why they see the instability for sand is exactly identical, which is a nice link.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Is there a simple way to say about to describe the tendency to form waves or not in terms of the Prude number of the flow?
Well, it.
Or is they not?
Well, it's tricky because due to the difference in the rheology for the sand, the instability appears close to the critical boundary and goes away as you move away from the critical boundary. And for glass beads, it's the reverse. And that just comes out of the algebra. I don't know a real physical explanation for it. Okay. So, some reservations. Both of these avalanches are propagating into stationary states, which I haven't addressed at all in this very simple theory. And so there's a zone of, if you like, passive ranking failure ahead of the avalanche that must be playing a significant role, but I haven't really accounted for it. I haven't talked about the lateral structure of the avalanches, although that would be certainly a feasible theoretical exercise to do that. And also, alpha actually varies with height. It's not a constant because as you go towards threshold, the flow profile is well known to become much more linear rather than the convex Bagley form. This is the answer to my question. I think that it's to me remarkable that you can use very simple depth averaged ideas to build a semi-quantitative theory of avalanches, which clearly places, for my mind, avalanches on the side of being a fluid mechanical phenomenon, that a lot of which can be understood from continuum mechanics. Leaves us somewhat at sea with the more geophysically relevant avalanches, but certainly gives me some hope that either by the end of this week or maybe in our next conference in Santa Barbara, we start to have a similarly powerful quantitative understanding of these phenomena as well. So I will stop and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. This was indeed a very fascinating theoretical physics talk, so I have to apologize to what I said in the beginning. But it's open for questions. Let's see if everybody has understood everything. Yeah.
So in the paper of Poulikin and Fortier 2002, they tried to apply this model to granular collapse of erodible beds.
Right.
So the same configuration as the one you showed with the collapse of the cup and not traversally uniform.
Right.
And they showed that this theory doesn't match constitutively the observations. Can you comment on that?
Well, I know that the 2003 paper, where they were looking at the waves, much better than the 2002 paper. I mean,
but, if you use this theory to simulate the wave generated by the collapse of the great afternoon of our erodible bed,
right,
you cannot reproduce.
My speculation would be, in that case, you actually need to understand the failure in more detail than I've done here. That is the worst thing about this approach, is that it's really completely silent about the zone of failure ahead of the collapse.
Yeah, a couple of questions.
Who was first?
Not me. Go on. Yeah. Is there slip at the bottom in all of these flows? Because That could explain the scaling proportion to H rather than H to the P. Yeah.
I mean, what I suspected that there did something like that. There must be some more plug flow character or some significance lift for the copper particles.
And the H stock that you use, does it depend on base roughness?
Does it depend? Well, I mean, the answer would be we did not in the experiments, the Borsonian Matthews experiments, there was not a variation of basal roughness. That was, there's a question about that. Is it?
No.
And so the answer is from these experiments, we don't know. There have been other experiments on the effect of the base, and I would say the situation is a bit murky. There seem to be configurations of the base where it does influence the flow.
Simulation,
like do ID experiments and so forth.
Simulation.
Another configurations were tested.
And simulations, it certainly does. So base roughness does affect that. And so you have to get H stock for each base and particle configuration in order to do the matching accurately. So that may be one other cause of uncertainty.
Okay. Just a point of clarification. You said that copper displayed a velocity proportional to H. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. And you put that into the kinematic and the dynamic waves, and that's, so that means
No, actually I didn't, because the only thing that would change would be alpha. And you know, and the form, you have to change the friction, you have to adapt your friction law to what you actually see in rheology. That's certainly the case. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the flow profile, that goes into alpha, which has a relatively weak impact on the
I'm not sure that I have understood everything you said, but it struck me that the linear velocity profile that is seen in copper, you can get something very similar in a kind of bagnodian fluid flowing over an erodible bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it erodes enough, then the velocity profile tends to become more linear,
right.
And in the limit it becomes basically just a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be interesting to see if I can apply this idea here.
Yeah, of course the copper particles. I mean, there's no two fluid character that we know about with those, as there would be in more turbidity kind of type experiment, or you know, flow over an erodible bed type experiment. But you know,
another question?
Yeah, there was one right before you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. On the subject of the linear profile, I remember when the Wren group discovered what's called the sidewall stabilized heat. It's actually a profile that has a concavity that is opposite to the diagonal profile.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, what they did, they fit what looked like a linear profile to find the thickness of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And but in fact there is something that exponentially goes down essentially to infinity, turns out.
Right.
But could that be what happened to the copper? Could it be just simply because there was a very highly dissipated boundary at the bottom that is due to the shape of these particles?
Well, it's not a sidewall effect.
No, in that case, I agree.
It could be, I mean, you're saying there may be some creep region at the base because the particles are so tightly locked together at the higher densities.
Usually the dissipation at the base determines the shape of the profile. When it's a highly dissipated boundary, then typically the concavity is inverted and it looks like a linear profile in the flowing region. Mm-hmm. However, when it is not so dissipated, it looks more like a Wagner profile.
Right.
Typically, those are the two.
That is, of course, possible.
Mm-hmm.
I might have missed your point. So, in the case that you saw the shock for the dust with sand, right?
Yes.
Based on the definition of your fruit number is still below one, but and you got that, right?
This is not necessarily a high fruit number. I mean, if you go back, you have to, it's not, okay, what are you doing? You are essentially comparing light with A. And, you know, there is, of course, there's a U in front of one, and there's a square root of GH here. So there is a Froude number character for that, but there are Froude numbers here. There's alpha. There's an alpha minus one. So the algebra, it's a little hard just to say, well, if you have a large Froude number, you'll have one effect, the effect one way and not the other way. And in fact, that is in fact exactly the point of Forterre and Poulikin in 2003, when they were looking at the stability problem, because they pointed out, you know, depending on the value of beta, where you can switch where the region of instability is and where the region of stability is, which is saying that, you know, thinking of it just in terms of Froude numbers a little less simplified.
Because I was really thinking simple, and as you mentioned, this is a hyperbolic nature of the current, and having that nonlinear term, it already projects a region of instability that, mm-hmm, depending on those coefficients, you might get a shock or not.
Mm-hmm. Any of the backup material that you want to show us? Or
I am standing in between 50 people. I will prioritize my backup.
If you like, if you wish, thank you again.